Welcome to the My Buddy Green podcast. I'm Jason Wachob, founder and co-CEO of My Buddy Green, and your host. If you're a regular listener, you know I am obsessed with coffee. My love affair with coffee started over 25 years ago. I drink it daily, I drink it early, and I drink it often. On a typical day, I'll have around 5 to 6 cups. Now, if I'm going to drink so much of something, I want to feel confident that it's good for my health. So you can imagine how freaked out I was when I found out that many coffee beans actually contain mold and microscopic toxins. Mold can form on coffee beans when they are grown, stored, or transferred in a moist, warm environment, and the supply chain of coffee makes it particularly susceptible to mold and the toxic chemicals called mycotoxins. According to some analysis, up to 50% of beans tested positive for mycotoxins, which can cause serious liver and kidney issues in high doses. Mycotoxins are almost impossible to see or taste, unlike the mold you might see from water damage in your house. And the effect that mycotoxin exposure has on humans isn't entirely clear, and there's a level of uncertainty that I, as a coffee lover, am just not comfortable with. I believe in compromise, but not when it comes to what I'm putting into my body. When I drink something so often, I want to know that I'm giving myself all the best possible benefits and not ingesting anything that is going to potentially negate all the other good stuff I'm doing. And once I learned about all the bad stuff like mold, mycotoxins, and other contaminants in coffee, I knew it was time to work on a better product. And I started asking myself the following questions. Would it be possible to source a USDA certified organic coffee that was high in polyphenols and had no mold, mycotoxins, pesticides, and heavy metals? And would we be able to test for all of the above? Could we find a coffee that meets all of our aforementioned standards and actually tastes great? No one wants to drink healthy coffee that tastes like crap. We want it to taste good. It took over a year, but we found a solution that delivers in full. Clean Coffee Plus. Our brand new coffee is handled in a way that reduces the risk of fungal growth and is rigorously tested for mold and mycotoxins, along with other nasties like pesticides and heavy metals. The testing that we do gives me confidence that the product I am drinking multiple times a day has nothing to hide. We test for an exhaustive battery of contaminants, 4 heavy metals, 10 microbial tests, 21 mycotoxins, 300 plus pesticides, and 20 solvents. I absolutely love our new Clean Coffee Plus, and I know you will too. So go to shop.mindbuddygreen.com/coffee20 to get 20% off your first order. You are going to love this coffee, and I really hope you try it. There are trillions of bacteria residing in your gut, and they are constantly evolving based on your inputs. According to Dr. Tim Spector, you can change your gut microbiome in about a week just by altering your diet. It begs the question, what do your gut microbes need in order to thrive? Tim is an epidemiologist, gut microbiome expert, award-winning scientist, and author. He's had over 1,000 original articles published in some of the world's top scientific journals, placing him in the top 1% most cited scientists on the planet. He's also scientific co-founder at Zoe and the author of Food for Life, his latest book focused on nutrition and health. On today's show, Tim shares his top science-backed nutrition tips, plus what to avoid for optimal gut health. We also talk about the future of personalized medicine, including the potential for an Ozempic-like probiotic. Let's get into it. So what do we know about the microbiome today and how it impacts our health?
We know that it's one of the most important organs in the body, and it controls many of the things that we had no idea about. So the microbiome is like a virtual organ, a bit like the liver, in that it produces thousands of chemicals, like mini pharmacies, that are key for our immune system, our brain health, metabolism, and many other parts of our functioning that we had no idea about. And it also provides vitamins and key other nutrients for our body. But we couldn't live without it, and it interacts with really everything that we do, every medicine we take, and is a crucial part of our body.
So if that's the case, the big question is, how does one eat for a healthy, optimal microbiome?
That's exactly the right question, because unlike our genes, you know, we can change our microbiomes, and we all have very different microbiomes, totally unique. And we know that you can change it pretty rapidly within about a week just by altering your diet. And we know that there are several key principles really to improving your gut microbiome. The first is to eat a greater variety of plants. And the goal we're setting at the moment is 30 different plants a week. And that includes not only fruits and veg, but nuts, seeds, herbs, and spices. So it's actually not as hard as you think to get the 30 in.
Right, because I hear 30, my brain went to, there's no way on earth I'm going to be able to do that. But when you broaden the definition to herbs, spices, nuts, and seeds, along with fruits and vegetables, I say, okay, possible.
And don't forget, coffee is also a plant. So that counts as well.
Got our coffee right behind us. I love it. You made so many people happy. Now I'm really interested. Keep on going. This is amazing.
Yeah. And coffee is a fermented plant that's a health food and is, you know, and it should be counted amongst those important things that we have every day. But, you know, adding just a mixed bag of nuts and seeds to your breakfast cereal or your yogurt can give you 10 plants. So once you start thinking about plants differently and adding herbs and spices to your meals, it's really not that hard. It's a misconception that we have about, you know, what actually a plant is. We think it's just kale and spinach, but it's so much more than that. So that's the key concept, is if you have a big diversity of plants in your diet, that keeps a bigger range and diversity of gut microbes in your gut, which means you can produce many more different chemicals when you need them because of these mini pharmacies that depend on the exact chemicals in the food. And this is why we realize that food is so much more complex than we've been led to believe. You know, there are over 50,000 identified chemicals in food, and each of those can be a target for a microbe that only lives off that particular chemical. So that's why the greater the range of chemicals you eat, the more you can make sure that you've got every possible species of good microbe inside you. So that's the first general principle. The second is eat the rainbow. And we've heard that before, but we didn't really know why that was. And it turns out that plants that are full of color, bright reds, purples, blues, yellows, all have different defense chemicals in them, phytonutrients that we now call polyphenols as a general word for associating them. And these defense chemicals that are useful in plants to keep them alive actually are like rocket fuel for our gut microbes, and they help them live longer and produce healthy chemicals like short-chain fatty acids and other things that help our immune system. So we now know why brightly colored or bitter foods, and this can include things like dark chocolate, coffee, olive oil, nuts, berries, even red wine comes into this category of high polyphenol foods that have been shown to be good for us.
Do you have a view or a strong opinion within each category that you must have, you know, blackberries, for example, if you're going to eat a fruit, or you must have broccoli, or for you, is it more about the range and the diversity, and it doesn't really matter? The reason I'm asking is we tend to get hung up on quote-unquote superfoods. You know, you must have a blackberry, or you must have broccoli, or whatever it might be. But what's your view?
There's no such thing as a superfood. I think we have to embrace that huge range of good foods there are around us and embrace the diversity and realize that, yes, there's a range between good and bad, but there isn't one. You can't live on a particular type of goji berry for the rest of your life and hope that's going to do everything, because each berry or each plant has a different level of chemicals that many of them we don't know about how good they are for us. So we always try and simplify to dumb it down to, you know, one chemical per berry or plant and think, oh, that's got resveratrol. Oh, you know, that's got carotene, or that's got lycopene. But actually, it's all about that diversity. So yes, I in general, there are certain berries that have higher fiber counts than others and higher polyphenols, but having a mix of them means that you don't have to worry about that. And you're sort of guaranteeing, you're giving yourself insurance, all those things we don't know about food that are likely to be good for you in those other chemicals that we haven't studied yet or haven't made a supplement about. So let's move away from this idea that there's one food in every category that, you know, if we eat that, we'll be fine. I think it's embracing the category, embracing the diversity, all the colors, trying to eat new things every week, trying to find new foods to taste and really get a greater breadth of food rather than limiting it to some one or two superfoods.
I love it. Let's bring back the fun. So, something else I noticed you said was yogurt. Yogurt's often polarizing. Do you have a view on a specific type of yogurt, whether it's, you know, grass-fed or Greek or something else? What's your take on yogurt?
Eating regular fermented foods is really part of how to improve your gut microbes. So that's my third sort of idea. And yogurt is one that everyone's heard about, you know, they know about. And my view is that pretty much most yogurts are generally healthy, except the ones that are highly processed and have artificial sweeteners or all the fat removed or, you know, fake bits of fruit in them. And so I'd go for a plain yogurt, and it doesn't really matter if it's Greek or not. That just depends how much water's in it, really. So it doesn't, you don't worry about the protein content or the anything else. So you just want it unadulterated yogurt. That's really all that matters. So there's a current debate about whether it should be milk or, you know, should it be soy. That then brings in other factors to think about. There's probably no difference for your gut microbes in that. And it becomes more a question of, are you eating for ethical reasons? Are you eating for the environment? You know, non-milk products are generally better for the environment than milk products. But health-wise, probably isn't a huge difference. And I know, you know, personally, if I have like an oat milk instead of a cow's milk, that spikes, you know, I know from the studies we've been doing with Zoe, that spikes my blood sugar. And so that's worse for me health-wise, but probably better for the planet. So in my book, I do discuss this sort of new way of looking at food, you know, from a health point of view, an ethics point of view, and a sort of global planet point of view. And I think increasingly we need to make these decisions as individuals, but knowing these are the factors that we have to take into consideration.
So it seems like diversity is key to a healthy microbiome. So I'm curious, why do you think carnivore, which is very restrictive, seems to work for some people, not all people, who are experiencing, you know, health issues?
As you said, only certain amount of people can tolerate a carnivore diet. And so vast majority of people can't. But there definitely are some people who can tolerate it and short term certainly feel better. And I think that's probably because they're cutting out a lot of ultra processed food by doing that. And ultra processed food, you know, these are the hyper palatable foods that make us overeat, that have lots of extra chemicals in them that are highly refined and don't fill us up, are the main health problem in the US. And I think that means they are shifting their diet to something that is more whole food based, which is good. But what we generally find is the few people that can tolerate it will end up having a less diverse gut microbiome as the years go on. And so I expect that short-term benefit they're getting long-term won't be still there, and that most people will end up with other problems because they're not getting that diversity of microbes that they should be. So I think the short-term gain, but long-term, many of these people will have problems down the line.
And this is where personalization comes in and doing blood work and DNA testing. But I largely agree that I think it's the absence of ultra-processed food. Once you remove ultra-processed food, you could probably embrace a whole host of diets, whether it's, you know, all meat, all fish, all yogurt, all to some degree in the short term, you're going to feel better. But I agree with your point, you need diversity in the long term.
I think we all do. And I think that, you know, that's how we've evolved. And We've evolved as omnivores, you know, to not have a very restrictive diet and to be flexible. And, you know, we need to be realizing that gut health is important for our immunity and how fast we age and fighting cancer and all these other aspects. And so we have to also bear in mind, you know, that the epidemiology suggests that people who eat lots of meat do have problems of extra heart disease and cancers. So there might be a small group of people that are, you know, naturally protected genetically from this or are able to cope with amounts of fat and high amounts of protein, but a lot of people won't. And, you know, overall, it's not something I would advocate. You know, there are better ways of giving up ultra-processed food.
Right. And I've seen success with both sides. I've seen success with people carnivore. I've seen success with people 100% plant-based. And this is where I think it's critical. And I think you'll agree. It's you're kind of removing the labels here. You know, I'll use this example for me, my N of one study, which your audience is probably sick of me mentioning. So I have my genetics. I'm a hyperabsorber of saturated fat. And so if I consume a lot of coconut milk, plant-based, or coconut oil, my lipid panel goes bananas. Very bad. I'm better off eating a lean cut of grass-fed beef, like very lean, like 93%, 7% fat. I'm better off eating the meat than having the high sat fat plant food because of the C16 fatty acid. And this is where the nuance comes in. And I love your view. Like not all, we need to remove all food is good or bad, you know? So I think that's just an example for me personally.
And while we don't label, you know, saturated fat as the same in every food.
100%.
It's very different in olive oil to coconut oil to in beef, you know? And the context is all important.
Yes, the short-chain fatty acids. So you mentioned on the subject of fat, you mentioned low-fat foods, not taking out the fat from foods. Can you explain to people why that's so bad?
There's several reasons. I mean, we're in this world where if you go to most supermarkets, you know, the dairy section, it's very hard to find stuff that hasn't had the fat taken out of it. And that means it's been more heavily processed as well. So it's been industrialized and they've either used mechanical methods or sometimes chemicals to get out that fat. And it's highly likely that product is ultra processed just by its nature. They've had to fiddle with it. And if they take the fat out, they've often had to put in starches and other stuff to make it taste good. So there's usually been a lot of manipulation behind the scenes to take what was a perfectly good product has a really nice mouthfeel and your tongue likes it. And, you know, we've been naturally raised on mother's milk to like that and then recreate it without that fat, which gives the tastiness. So that's one reason. And the other is a lot of the vitamins are contained in the fat as well. A lot of the nutrients are bound up with it. They get thrown out when you remove the fat as well. And increasingly, there's no evidence now that low-fat products are actually healthy for you, and increasing evidence they might actually be less healthy. So they might make you overeat more, you know, not make you fill you up. And they're being manipulated by the food industry just so you eat more and more of them. And, you know, they're doing it because they can produce it even cheaper because it's more industrial. So I think generally just avoid. There's no medical indication to eat them anymore, and we should be just going back to the whole food, the more genuine original article.
Yes. So beyond doing a stool test, which my understanding at this point in time, I'll say in early 2024, it's informative, but it's just a snapshot because, as you mentioned, the microbiome changes quickly. So beyond doing a stool test, how can someone assess the health of their microbiome? Is it the amount of stools on a daily basis, what the stool looks like, the good old-fashioned Bristol stool chart? Or how can someone get it? Are they bloated? How can someone get a flavor for how they're doing?
I still think the stool test with a microbiome is the gold standard at the moment. And at the company I founded, Zoe, we've now, you know, got nearly 200,000 samples. So we do have a pretty good idea of what healthy is and what healthy isn't. It's the combination of healthy microbes compared to unhealthy microbes, that ratio, which I think is really important, and we're able to track people's improvements and things with that. But not everyone can afford those tests, and there are other things you can do.
We'll link to it in the show notes. We'll make a note to circle back after. We'll link to it in the show notes so people can check it out.
Yeah, some people might want to do the proper test, but if you don't want to, there are other things, as you've talked about. First thing is just listening to your body and the symptoms. So whether you get bloating and constipation intermittently, that's a sign of poor gut health, and it's likely to be associated with poor microbial health. And the other one is what's called transit time, which is how long it takes for food in your mouth before it comes out in the toilet. And as part of the Zoe test, we did actually do a free test that everyone can do. It. You just take a bit of blue dye, put it in a pastry or something, and you time when it goes in your mouth and you time when it comes out. And we can put a link to that, the recipe for that. And you time this, and it turns out that the average for the United States is about 26 hours for it to come out the other end. And there's a big wide range, though, so between about 10 hours and about 10 days.
Wow. Where do you want it to be? What's optimal?
We think somewhere between 18 and 20 hours, we think, is about where the sweet spot is. We're still investigating that. It might be country dependent. We're doing this around the world. We looked at this, and this transit time was actually better than the Bristol stool chart, which I think you mentioned, in terms of distinguishing good and bad microbes and linking it to the microbiome results. So this transit time seems to be a good indicator of your gut health. And, you know, it roughly links to people going to the toilet at least once a day, producing their stool sample once a day. And people who only do it twice a week have very poor gut health. And yet, huge numbers of the population, you know, are unfortunately in that situation. They think it's still normal just to go once or twice a week. And we need to change this mentality and realize that, you know, the speed of transit means everything's working really healthily and you've got really good diversity of gut microbes. Everything's working really well.
In terms of everything working really well, what do we know about our ability to manage weight and how the microbiome affects our ability to manage weight or lose weight, which a lot of people want to do these days?
There's a lot of data on the animal models, mice in particular, showing that you can manipulate weight by manipulating the gut microbes. So we know, you know, you can make mice fat or thin by transplanting them with different microbes. And the question is, how does that translate to humans? Because mice, you know, we're not mice. We have very different lives. And I don't think we've fully answered what proportion of weight is controlled by your gut microbes. But we see everyone who has any problem associated with obesity always has less diverse microbes than someone who is thin. And so we know it's correlated with it. And so gut health is definitely correlated with the ability to control weight. Some of that might be a consequence, and some of it is likely to be a cause. So it goes in both directions, because if you are overweight, then you're likely to be slightly more have an inflammatory gut. Your stress levels in your body are up, so good inflammation. And we know that certain microbes like that environment, and those guys, bad microbes, will enjoy living in that scenario as well. So that's the consequence. But we think from the mouse models, you can definitely cause or reduce obesity by the microbes. So I think they do play a role, but interestingly, they've done some fecal transplant studies in humans, and it turns out it's not that effective as a weight loss procedure. So 10 years ago, people thought everyone would be having this routinely, like, you know, going to the dentist, and it hasn't worked out that way. So it looks like it's more complicated. But from our studies at Zoe, we see a relationship between obesity and gut health, but it seems to be more that you're able to control your appetite and your weight better with a healthy microbiome, but it's not an all or nothing thing. So that the healthier your gut microbes are, perhaps the less intense the signals of hunger are, and you're more able to not have those big fluctuations in weight and other things. So I think it plays a role, but it's not as big as we thought it was 10 years ago.
So in the same way, someone could take Ozempic and take an injection, which essentially curbs appetite, it will cause someone to lose weight and also lose muscle and fat. I think the muscle piece is an important call out, because you don't want to lose muscle, you just want to lose the fat. In the same way, people can use that as an effective protocol to lose weight. Do you think we'll get to a place someday where there will be, you know, a prescription for a specific strain of a probiotic or group of strains where we know that they're effective in essentially curbing the appetite via the microbiome? Do you think that's possible?
Yes, we do know that some microbes do actually produce the same chemicals that are being enhanced in Ozempic. So these GLP-1 chemicals and these gut hormone ones can be produced by microbes. So I think in the future, we'll be perhaps looking either probiotics or possibly prebiotics, which are like fertilizers for the microbes, that will actively increase GLP-1 and so act in a way similar to these drugs. So that's very much current science. We know it's possible. We just haven't worked out the best way to do it in humans yet. So I think this is definitely going to be a place. And I think there's going to be a real area where we'll be able to combine these Ozempic-type drugs, the GLP-1 drugs, with microbial or therapies, which will either be foods or probiotics, to enhance those effects and maybe reduce the dose of those drugs or have them less frequency or be able to come off them eventually, which is important.
Interesting. So you mentioned all the data you're sitting on at Zoe, a vast amount of data. What's been the most interesting to you or jaw-dropping?
I think it was when we first got the results, was because the first study was done on just 1,000 individuals, which was the biggest study of its kind at the time. We gave 1,000 people exactly the same meal, and we saw a 10 to 20-fold difference in their sugar and fat responses to that same meal. And that was a big eye-opener because, up to then, we just assumed all the medical researchers report an average level. They say, this is your triglyceride level on average. This is your blood sugar level on average after a meal. But nobody was average because it was all over the place. And it just showed us, and then we looked, and 600 of these 1,000 people were twins. So we could tell even identical twins who are genetic clones, they had very different responses to the same breakfast muffin. So, one would have a high fat response, the other a low fat response. And this really was, because for 30 years, I've been studying twins. So I was a big believer in genetics. And so for me, suddenly saying, well, our responses to food really are hardly anything to do with genetics. That was, to me, a bit of a wow moment, which was actually good, not for my speciality, but it was good because, it's empowering for people to think they can actually change that. And we can manipulate our microbes. We can change, through our food choices, what's going on in our bodies. It's not all predetermined by our genes.
The genes are not your destiny.
Absolutely not. And I think this is very much, the way the research is going in nutrition, moving away from this idea there's nothing you can do about it to really realizing that the food choices you make are the most important ones you can make for your life. And we all have the power to do that. We just need the information to make the right choices.
Yes. And it's, I haven't been in the space as long as you have. I'm coming up on 15 years. And to be quite honest, I'm getting tired of the nutrition conversation in that so many of the experts, personalities or influencers, if you will, I think it's somewhat changing, but still many take an approach of, you must have this food or you can't have that food. And the reality is bioindividuality is the future. We're all unique. coconut milk may be, you know, the worst thing in the world for me, but for someone else, it could be pure heaven in terms of, we don't know.
Well, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. I think personalized probiotics are going to be the future as well. You know, there isn't one probiotic that suits everybody because all our microbes are totally different. Personalized prebiotics, I think, you know, I know from my Zoe results that, you know, carbs I do really badly with, but I'm really good at dealing with fats. So that means for me, I totally changed my breakfast. But, you know, I'm very different to my wife. She still enjoys a croissant in the morning, which is really annoying, you know?
So what do you eat in a day? Walk us through what you eat in a day.
Well, I tend to have my breakfast late these days because I try and leave a 14-hour intermittent fast to give my gut microbes a rest. Then, so I'd normally have breakfast around 10:30 or something like that in the morning. And I'd have full-fat yogurt, Greek, or doesn't matter, mixed with kefir, because kefir has got 10 times more microbes than yogurt. And then I add whatever I have in the fridge in terms of fruit or berries. I can use frozen berries if they're out of season. And I throw over I have my diversity jar, which contains about 10 nuts and seeds mixed together. So by my breakfast, I've already got about, you know, a dozen of my 30 a week sorted out. And then my lunch can be just cheese and kimchi or a salad. I have a fairly light lunch, or it can be an apple and a handful of mixed nuts. And my evening meal is predominantly plant-based. I eat meat maybe once or twice a month, and if it has to be really good, and fish maybe a few more times, just generally when I'm out, but mainly plant-based with as many diverse, interesting plants as I can. I don't eat white rice anymore. Don't really eat bread unless I made it myself anymore, because I know they really spike my sugars. And I usually have a glass of red wine and plenty of cheese and dark chocolate.
Amen. Well, you're in the UK. You're so close to France. How can you resist?
When I went vegan, the one thing I really missed was cheese. So I'm still waiting for the vegan cheeses to catch up. They're getting better all the time, but they're not quite there yet.
And so you mentioned the 14-hour fast. What role does meal timing play in our microbiome? You know, how much space do we need between meals or overnight, in your view? Does it play a role at all?
It absolutely does. And there's a lot of science now showing that just like humans, microbes need to sleep and they need a rest period when we're not throwing food at them. So we've done studies in our own cohort and Zoe of showing the people who leave having a short interval between their last snack at night and their morning one have much worse microbes, worse blood sugar results, and generally put on weight. So I think this whole snacking idea, which in the US I think provides about nearly a quarter of the calories on average, is partly to blame. That late night snack, really bad. And you've got to leave, I think, at least 12 hours for optimal gut health. The more distance you leave, the better, but it gets harder to sustain that for many people. So it's that balance between optimizing your gut health and what can you do for years, you know, to make it effective. And some people find it much easier than others to do this fasting. We did a giant study with Zoe of 100,000 people in the UK, asking them to do intermittent fasting for 3 weeks, trying to get this 14-hour window. And a third of third of people managed it, but a third really hated it. So I think, you know, like everything else, it's personalized. Some people find easy to avoid snacking, others don't. But those that did really got improvements in their gut microbes, their gut health, the bloating. They had reduced hunger, better mood, better energy, better sleep. So I'd advise everyone to give it a go, but don't guarantee that it's going to be perfect for you.
And I think the thing that I've found is as I've gotten older, I can't do beyond 13 or 14. There was a time when I was doing 16 and 18, and I was starting to lose lean muscle mass, and I wasn't able to get enough protein. You need protein as you age too, like, because we're losing muscle mass. I just couldn't do it anymore. It was like in my mid-40s, I remember it's like, where's my muscle? Where's it going? I need to eat more. And it's a struggle. If you're doing 16 to 18 hours, essentially a 6 to 8 hour feeding window to get everything in, that's difficult. That's like my big caveat. As you get older, when you're younger, you probably get away with it. But once you hit 40, I think it becomes more challenging, and then more challenging at 50, 60, and so on.
I agree. And I think we shouldn't be advocating these extreme regimes. We should be going for the modest ones that most people can do for long periods of time for the rest of their life, you know? So that's generally my philosophy, is to try and make people do things that are, you know, not extreme, but they can carry on, adhere to for decades, not just for a few months. And I think that's, you know, and everyone's got their own point. They can fiddle around with it, but let's not set the bar so high that they feel they've failed if they haven't got their 18-hour fast in, you know, like, you know, you can do it for a while, but, you know, we've all got to live social lives and with other people and jobs and travel and, you know, it's not easy.
Extreme regimes. Should we segue to politics in America right now? Or maybe we'll save that for another show. So, you know, look, the microbiome is vast. Outside the gut, we've got the skin microbiome, the oral microbiome, the ocular microbiome, microbiomes everywhere. What do we know today beyond the gut in terms of what we can do to optimize and how it influences our health?
Well, the gut is where most of the action is. And because the gut controls most of the immune system, we know that there are links between, say, a skin disease and your gut as well. And there's clear links between eczema and what's going on in your lower intestine. So there's a lot of communication between what's going on in your gut and the rest of your body. So it's hard to separate them completely. We know that the brain and the gut are talking to each other all the time. But we think there's signaling, say, between the microbes in your mouth and the lower part of your gut to warn it about food and fullness. And so they are communicating a lot. We know also that microbes in your mouth, if they're inflammatory, will send signals to your brain. And there are now links between the microbes that cause gingivitis, causing a sort of inflammation low grade that increase your risk of dementia and heart disease. So increasingly, these microbes in different parts of our body are acting like as sensors of stress or inflammation and feeding back signals to other bits of the body, which unfortunately, you know, can lead to poor health. So increasingly, we're seeing this, the microbiome as part of the defense system of the body that is acutely aware of the environment and feeding back to both to the microbial center in the gut, but also to the brain and linking to the immune system. So I think they're all linked up. And so it's a mistake to think of them as completely separate, but we know most about the gut because it's easier to study. The mouth is reasonably easy to study, but it's very hard to study the skin properly. And where there's very few microbes, you know, the contamination makes it technically quite tough, but we think they're all interconnecting, which is fascinating. And they are so important for our immune health that, and our immune health is increasingly the key to aging and fighting cancer and heart disease and everything. So it's a huge resurgence of interest in our immune system. And all these new drugs that are fighting cancer are basically just boosting our immune system. And so this is what our microbes are meant to do. So I think it's just showing the importance, whether you're fighting cancer or aging, of feeding your gut microbes right so they can keep our immune system in top shape.
So you mentioned microbes and fighting cancer, and I'll segue to the future of this field. You know, where is the science headed? Where do you think we're going to be in a couple of years from now? What do you think are we going to be talking about in terms of medical breakthroughs and the microbiome?
Well, I think it'll be routine that everyone will have a microbiome test before they go on cancer therapy, for example, because we know we did a study on metastatic melanoma and showed that the main reason people survived or died was the state of their gut microbes when they started immunotherapy. Okay. And these are, you know, these are drugs that cost $200,000 a year. So just by having your microbiome boosted for 2 months before you went on therapy could possibly double your chance of living. And there are many other diseases now treated with immunotherapies that need to be also be treating the gut microbes at the same time. So I think we're going to whether it's autoimmune diseases, whether it's all these cancers. I think we're going to start seeing nutrition and microbial health coming into it. And you know, these doctors who have been resistant to knowing about diet and microbes are going to have to learn about it more and go back to medical school and really understand it, because it's going to be crucial to your chances of survival. And I think we're going to see more interesting stuff about side effects of drugs. Many people take drugs that don't work for them, like a third of people taking antidepressants doesn't work. And that's because they have certain microbes that are inactivating the drug, because drugs are just like other chemicals they see in food. So microbes see them the same way. And so we'll be giving additional treatments to those people as well to make those drugs work or more effective. So I think we're going to see really microbiome coming in more and more into mainstream medicine in everyday life, and realizing these things have got to be personalized to us, because it explains so much more of the randomness of why some things work in medicine and things other things don't. And it's going to be super exciting. And I think there is a huge future in personalized nutrition. I think you were talking about earlier about you and meat and these other things. You know, we can now do these tests, and as the numbers in databases like Zoe get, you know, towards 1 million people, we can start to really drill down and give really fine personalized advice about exactly what to eat and what drugs to take and what probiotics you should be taking in the future. So I think, you know, the future really is personalized.
It is personalized, I agree. But if you had to generalize, you know, we covered a lot today. What are three things that you believe everyone would benefit from tomorrow? You know, one diversity in terms of food. What else? What are a couple other things that everyone would benefit from tomorrow for those who want to up-level their gut health?
Diverse plants, number one. Number two, I would say, is have fermented foods, several portions every day, and go for a variety of fermented foods, because then you get the diversity of different microbes in them. So we're talking the 4Ks, the kimchis, the kefirs, the kombuchas, the krauts, you know, Japanese food, miso, not just cheese and yogurt. Then the third takeaway message has got to be reduce ultra-processed foods. Go for whole foods instead, because ultra-processed foods, not only do they make you overeat by 25%, but they're also bad for your gut microbes because of all those chemicals. So the whole foods contain all the real stuff. So those three things together: diversity, fermented foods, cut out UPFs.
Love it. We covered so much today. Is there anything else we didn't want to touch on, or any words of wisdom or anything you want to leave with our audience before we close?
I think just realize that the food choices you make every day are the most important things you can do for your health. And that, you know, we all have the power to change ourselves. And now's a great time to do it. And we now have these tools to assist people. And if you want to learn more, my book is very extensive and covers an A to Z of...
I'll hold it up. It is a Bible. It is thick. It is dense. It is solid.
There's everything in there. I can't remember everything that's in there. So you need to read it. We also, if you want to actually do some personalized nutrition yourself, go to the Zoe website and you can get a testing kit and this whole program that is designed to make you eat better for years without cutting out anything, without reducing calories, without talking about eliminating anything. It's all about adding stuff to your diet. So I think changing the way you eat doesn't have to be bad news. It can be actually very exciting, and you get to eat many new exciting things. And people have done that. They do feel better. They feel better, more energy, more mood. And many of them also losing a little bit of weight, but the key thing is they feel better. And I think that's what everyone should be aiming at.
Amazing. Tim, thank you so much.
Been a pleasure.